Texas Talking Ah. What was that that you said? Texas Talking Ah. Gonna hoop upside your head. Texas Talking Ah. Tell me, who can you trust when Texas guys are in Texas?
Howdy, everybody. This is Jason Roberts with the Jason Roberts Band. Thankfully, Reeve and the Trib team will leave the singing and fiddling around to me, and I'll leave them to serve up your news of the week. Here's your host, Reeve Hamilton. Ha ha!
Thank you. This is reporter Reeve Hamilton here with the Tribcast for the third week of July. I am joined by editor-in-chief and CEO Evan Smith.
Hey, Reeve.
Reporter Jay Root.
Howdy.
And reporter Julian Aguilar.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us, everyone.
He's so psyched that he's back in Austin.
Well, we haven't had Julian
on. Already. That's what
are you drunk already?
Yeah, we haven't had him on for a long time since he lives in El Paso.
This podcast recorded live at the Jackalope.
That's a very local reference for people in Austin.
Yeah, we wouldn't want to say anything on the podcast that only three people get Reeve, because that would be wrong, right?
You know, I just think we should play more broadly. Not really. Let's just delve right into pretty in-the-weeds politics stuff, shall we? Jay, maybe you could update us on, since we've getting campaign finance reports back from the last reporting period, who between Greg Abbott, who's Republican, running for governor, and Wendy Davis, the Democrat, who raised the most money?
Well, funny you should ask. That's actually a point of dispute, as you might imagine. Wendy Davis is claiming credit for $11.2 million, and Greg Abbott says he raised $11.1 million. So Wendy is claiming that she raised that amount of money. However, there has been some complaining and some, I guess, discrepancy about what should be counted and what shouldn't be counted. We also, you know, in a way, kind of burying the lead here, because the really huge figure that needs to be talked about in a way is the $35.6 million that Greg Abbott reported having in the bank. And as far as we've been able to determine, that's a record. Tony Sanchez spent $70 million in 2002, but his cash on hand was his personal bank account, which is formidable, and he never left money in the bank. So, but you know, going back probably I don't think anybody has ever put together a war chest that large.
And the practical consequence of this is that it costs, it's estimated, about $1 million a week to advertise in a market as big as Texas if you're running for statewide office. And if Greg Abbott didn't raise another dollar for the remainder of this campaign, he would have so much money to spend on statewide advertising that it would really overwhelm whatever the Davis campaign attempted to do. Now, she does have a fair amount of money, and by comparison to Bill White, I believe that the Wendy Davis supporters were tweeting the other day when the numbers came out that at this point in the campaign, Wendy Davis has already raised more than Bill White raised for the entirety of the campaign. But it gets to how you calculate that number.
It does.
Isn't that
get
what
to
it
how
is?
You calculate
there was
that
no
number.
Battleground Texas
right.
at the
right.
time.
How much of that is actually in her campaign?
Or how much does she have access to? Mm-hmm. Now, that may be
she has $8 million or so, in between $8 and $9 million in her own account for Wendy Davis for governor and her Senate account, which has almost $4 million in it. So between those two accounts that she completely controls herself and nobody can but her yeah. can decide what to do with, that's $8 million.
But she will benefit from outside spending.
Absolutely.
On her behalf, but so theoretically would Abbott, and that $35 million doesn't count anything that American Crossroads or the Koch-funded super PACs or anything else that anybody does on the conservative end of things.
Correct.
Outside money would presumably be deployed over and above that $35 for Abbott.
Correct.
Right.
So and
it's
that,
not
that,
apples to apples.
Well, and that's where the rub really comes in is like, okay, so Battleground, and correct me if I'm wrong, I totally remember, or I think I remember, Jeremy Byrd, the consultant for Battleground, a former Obama guy, saying that this was not a, that Battleground was not about one candidate. It was not about one election, that this was an effort to turn Texas blue or to at least make Texas more competitive, more hospitable to the Democratic Party, and that this is the kind of grassroots infrastructure that is supposed to outlive one candidate. And as I recall, maybe, again, I'm hallucinating
no,
here.
No, but of course you're right, because Battleground came along before Wendy Davis did.
Right, right. It came before Wendy Davis. And the other thing is that you know, this is something that's supposed to last for a really long time. And the reason that they started this joint fundraising effort, the way it was told to me, is a lot of Democratic donors didn't want to invest all of their money into one candidate that then after the election's over, it's just gone and there's nothing lasting.
So is the Vanderbilt campaign also counting some of this outside money as part of their effort?
They are not.
They're not.
They're not. I've gotten quite a lot of pushback, as you might imagine, from the Democratic side, and they're basically saying, look, you have to count every single dollar. Everything that we're doing is to get Wendy elected, but a lot of this, some of this money was not in-kinded to the Wendy Davis campaign. I mean, for example, so there's consultant fees. Fundraisers are getting consulting fees. They're registering voters. They're holding education type little seminars for people to get to become voter registrars. So there's a whole lot of infrastructure here that's supposed to benefit everybody. That is the kind of thing that a party would normally do, like a Republican Party. So my question is, if you're going to count this for one candidate, on the Democratic side, should we go in and say, okay, well, you know, actually the Republican Party has a field program. They've got a voter registration effort. Do we have to count that for Greg Abbott? Because obviously they all want Greg Abbott. I mean, yes, they want other candidates to get elected. They want John Cornyn to be reelected, but it's for everybody.
Look, in the end, what you said at the beginning, I think, is probably the relevant point to take forward,
the
which
rest is just fluff.
Leaving aside the question of math, the difference between how much money he has and how much money she has is significant, right?
Yeah, it really is.
And given the fact that she has a larger hurdle to get over, the math problem that she has, we've talked about forever in a state like Texas right now, the fact that she has such a gap to make up and won't make up in fundraising, you know, she was never going to have as much as he did. She was going to at best have enough. And the question is, does this point her in the direction of having enough? Maybe, maybe not.
But, you don't always don't have, you know, money doesn't always win. I mean, you have to have enough money to get your message out. And I think it's fair to say that she'll have enough money to get a message out. You know, it's if you have one really just great effective ad, you know, that can have an impact. But I mean, Abbott can like rotate an ad. He can rotate ads. He can find out what
he's got. So much money, he's running movie theater trailers. Right.
I mean, the number of six figure donations that he has received is just extraordinary.
So you and I were looking the other day at the list of the donations to the Abbott campaign this last period. It was 12 different $250,000 individual donations. That doesn't count the hundreds or the 75s or the 50s. There were 12 $250,000 donations in this period. If you took out the trial lawyers and the unions and the comparable kind of institutional givers, the largest gift that the Davis campaign got from an individual is $50,000.
But they were touting their large number of small donors, mm-hmm. right? So they're sort of hitting you with a different message.
They're saying it's not about large donors, right? And the Davis campaign is fine to say that, and Abbott campaign says it's about in-state donors, and they've got a ton more out-of-state money than we do, and it's kind of the same narrative that you've heard about fundraising.
Of course, it's not about anything specifically until that thing decides to give you tons of money.
Well, and I think you have to give Wendy Davis credit for these small donors. That's something that is really unusual. We haven't seen that. I've never seen that in a Texas race. I mean, that was sort of one of Obama's great innovations.
And Howard Dean, in fact, back in 2004, right?
I mean, you know, really, you know. And we
haven't seen that in a Texas race on either side or in the Democratic side.
On the Democratic side, I think Republicans have done better with small donors than, you know, the sort of the mom and pop business Main Street type donors. But I'm talking about like a national phenomenon and having people like really get invested in her and she sort of became a superstar. Right. And so we actually have not seen that. So that is new. And
are they counting?
That's Wendy specific.
Are they counting people buying the Vogue magazine she was in as in kind contributions to her campaign?
No, but they did count Willie Nelson $250,000 contribution, which was in kind.
Which was him doing a concert?
Him doing a concert, right. And so, you know, I mean, you have to put some value on it, right? And it's got to be, I guess, a fair market
value. Why didn't they just put a $2 million value on it?
I'm assuming if anybody knows the street value of things, it's probably Willie. But $250,000 seems low to me, actually. You sort of show up at Willie Nelson's agent's door and say, we'd like Willie to play a concert for us, a benefit concert. You think you can get it for $250,000? That's super cheap.
Yeah, I guess.
I think it's
worth pointing out, though, there was also a $140,000 in-kind donation from Steve Mostyn, who is her largest donor. So you have... You know, what is that?
That's $370,000 in kind that they're counting as part of their fundraising.
Right, which eclipsed, you know, Abbott.
So you take that out and you're down below 11.1.
Well, now he had a lot of in kind stuff too, but there wasn't sort of this Willie thing like 250, and there also wasn't you didn't have one of his largest donors giving an in kind donation of that size.
Is Ted Nugent more like a $75K?
I think Willie should have said that it was 420. That's how much it was. $420,000 in kind.
Well, also as a percentage,
that would have generated better press.
As a percentage, the Wendy's in kind contributions were larger. So anyway,
what about further down the ballot? How are the Vandepute Patrick dollar figures?
Well, Vandepute's doing fine, it looks like, relative to expectations on raising money, and she's got enough money to be as competitive as she's going to be able to be. I'm fascinated by the Patrick Vandepute race on a lot of levels, because if you take the conventional wisdom of the Davis Abbott race that it's effectively an Abbott win in the absence of a precipitating event, then the focus shifts down to the next race on the ballot, which is the lieutenant governor's race. And while the polling shows Patrick ahead of Vandepute, in fact, in our poll, I think he had the largest margin of any of the statewides, was Patrick over Vandepute. At the same time, there's this perception that, you know, boy, this race is fluid. Something could happen. No evidence of this, but just this sort of sense, oh, you know, something could happen here, and she's holding her own on the fundraising side, and just this opportunity. You know, it remains to be seen whether there's really anything there. But, you know, she did fine, and the numbers, the fundraising numbers were more parity, right? It was more parity in the lieutenant governor's race.
It didn't do anything to hurt the VAT perception based in reality.
No.
Whether it is or not, you know.
Was there anything surprising in her report? I mean, it's because you've heard a lot about some Republicans that are going to side with Vandepute over Patrick. Has anybody?
Everybody wants to know whether that story that the business community or that the, you know, that some prominent Republican Hispanics are going to cross over and support whatever else, that that's going to somehow make this big difference. You know, we've heard some big names, unconfirmed, who are supporting.
But, well, some have said that they're going to support it.
Some additional names who are kind of like, you know, consequential Republican brands who I'm going to support. And presumably there'll be some people who won't say it out loud but will in the voting booth go, you know, whatever. But if you assume that the Democrats begin at about 42-43% based on recent historical trends, you got to get a whole lot of those people to change the math of the election. And, you know,
The burden
is still on the Democrats to prove that these races are competitive.
That's the real problem. I mean, you know, you have Abbott sitting on this huge war chest, and he's going to be on the airwaves. And, you know, how many of those people can you get to switch off of Abbott?
You'd have to have Abbott Vandepute voters.
Right, exactly. And there's, right? I just don't know how many of
you
those.
You remember
there
back
are.
In 98, you had Bush Sharp voters.
You had
a certain number of those. It's not impossible. And in fact, in Wendy Davis's senatorial district, the last two elections, you've had Davis-McCain voters and Davis-Romney voters. It's not impossible to get people to split their tickets.
Well,
the burden was on the Democrats to prove that they're going to get enough of those guys.
Well, Bush-Benson, wasn't it Bush-Benson in 88? Do you remember that? I mean, that was – Benson won.
Right.
So
if they report their fundraising in a way that people can sort of pick at and pick apart, does that hurt their ability to – prove that it is a competitive race? Does that hurt the narrative if they're trying to establish that we are competitive,
the Vandepute people had to answer Julian's question, because I've not actually spent a lot of time poring over the reports. Alexa Ura, who reports on the lieutenant governor's race for us, has done much more reporting on this than I'm just flying
You're
over
You're just
this.
A guy.
I'm just a guy. But You can be sure that if in the Vandepute fundraising report were prominent Republicans giving significant contributions,
you would have heard
they'd be flying a plane over the Capitol with a banner that said that. And I think so far it's not really been about the individual contributions.
Would that really be the best use of those Republican donors' contributions, though?
A plane. It's like 1920, right? No, I agree.
But, you know, look, if polls in October are showing that Dan Patrick is winning this easily, the big money donors, you know, they're not going to be taking any kind of risk like that. They've got too much at stake. Just got too much at stake. They're not going to risk putting their necks out there, and then the lieutenant governor, the future, you know, the next lieutenant governor is going to remember all of that.
Of course.
Well, let's move from politics to real issues that are happening now.
Right, because there's no politics caught up in the border or anything.
Yeah, sure, exactly. Not at all. So we have Julian with us, which is a rare treat. And
well, thank you.
So we haven't been talking about the border as much because you haven't been with us, but you are here now. Is there a resolution in sight? We know we hear about this every day. Surely it must be coming to a nice, clean end.
Yeah, it's going to happen any day now. I don't think so. Just saw before coming in here that now the Republicans and the Democrats are pretty much going to be locked into a staring contest because of what the Republicans want to see attached to the supplemental or not included. But basically, and you know, I was thinking now it's my time to talk. You guys say campaign finance, it just goes way over my head because this border issue has been there's so many sort of angles to it. There's so many stories, and every single day it seems to either you know grow or change or something else comes. But it seems like it's going to be a big mess right now. I mean, you have the Cuellar, Corn, and Humane Act, which would pretty much repeal a 2008 provision that requires that unaccompanied minors from non-contiguous countries are turned over to ORR, the Office of Refugee Resettlement and Health and Human Services, unlike Mexico where they're automatically sent back if they waive their right to a hearing or whatnot. And I think that is in itself going to be, you know, at the state level we call it a Christmas tree. I think that might be used to attach a lot of different things or trying to move a lot of certain things. Chairman McCaul has promoted his H.R. 1417, which is a border security bill. That got bipartisan support. But there's just so many layers to it. There's so many little nuanced things going on down there. And, you know, caught in the balance, you know, the Democrats say there's a 22-year-old Honduran woman with two kids and so that scared out of her, you know, out of her wits, doesn't know what to do. And on the other side, you say, hey, well, what about our public schools? We got to take care of our own first. And there's just a lot hanging in the balance.
I thought yesterday, as we sit here on Thursday morning, I thought that the news yesterday that Ted Cruz was going to introduce his own legislation on this to the right of the legislation that Cornyn co-authored. Mm-hmm. Kind of come back to this question of, okay, let's not talk about politics. Of course, this is politics. The Cruz-Cornyn dynamic, as revealed in all this, is just absolutely fascinating to me.
Well, I mean, the Cruz thing likely isn't going to get anywhere. Obviously,
doesn't
when the
matter.
When the Senate, no, it doesn't. But when the
right.
See, but
sometimes you win by losing.
When the Senate
he's
bill,
he's proven that a couple different times since he's been in office.
That's when the strategy. Senate bill came out, Senate Bill or S-744, the immigration reform bill, more than a year ago. I mean, he was probably one of the first ones. You know, five amendments, very extreme, very to the right of where everybody else was going. I mean, you know, who knows the Cuellar Cornyn thing might, you know, will go anywhere. There could be, you know, other watered down versions of it. But yeah, I mean, that, you know, that goes to show how far apart they are on the issue. Cornyn was in El Paso visiting Juarez, and he actually, like, praised what the Mexicans were doing, and you know he said things are different there, and he got a lot of heat from Republicans for that, for saying that you know Mexico is actually a safer country.
I think Perry. I wonder if you all think this. I think, and I suspect, Reeve, you talked about this to some degree last week when the president was in town.
I have no idea.
I think Perry has had a very good week. You know,
we did talk about that.
Perry, and I, but I think it's continued. You know, Perry had an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal.
This is another week.
You know, on whatever day it was this week, and has continued to make the rounds on television. You know. Perry needs to differentiate himself from a very formidable field of people who are looking at running for president in 2016. This is an issue that, by all rights, should be his. It should be a Texas issue because we are disproportionately involved in this conversation. You know, people remembered him from the last campaign as the guy who couldn't count to three and, you know, constantly made gaffes over the course of the thing, couldn't beat Herman Cain, you know, which is not an impressive outcome. Now he's actually – he looks like he's gone toe-to-toe with the president. He looks tough. He's, you know, he's compassionate but also, you know, he's rock-ribbed conservative. And I actually think that Perry comes out of this whole thing looking good, and also by not being in Washington is not caught up in all this legislative back and forth.
But Cruz, do you think Obama played it wrong by not going down to the border with him?
I think Wendy Davis would say that Obama played it wrong. I think that there are Democrats who've said that Obama didn't
I think there are a lot of Democrats on the border that said
it was a bad,
yeah, it was a bad move. Going back to what you said about the governor, I mean, I agree that right now, but how long is it going to last? Because he is not giving any different answers. He's, you know, his the border's not secure. He said that. He keeps saying it. Send 1,000 National Guard troops. It's like, okay. And during the committee hearing, I mean, Congressman Vela asked him, said, Governor, you know, we appreciate what you're doing and DPS and we're all on board, but what is going to happen if you send the National Guard down there? First of all, they can't really engage in law enforcement activities. Chairman McCall said, if we need to free them up to do more than, you know, than push paper behind desks or whatnot. So that's what they can do now. But Congressman Vela asked the question. He said, so say you have 1,000 National Guard troops on the border. It's not going to change the people that are coming over. You can't put them on Mexican soil, and all they're going to do is they're going to receive more and receive more and receive more.
They turn themselves in. That's what's so ridiculous about this argument. I mean, the unaccompanied minors turn themselves in. They're looking. That's just more people that they can turn themselves into.
They're turning themselves into Parks and Wildlife, to local PD, to DPS.
I mean, they look at the first guy with a badge, and they're like, "Hey, take me." And they know that we have this process that. Set up for that. I mean, the real problem is a judicial problem. They need to have more people to process this. And, of course, the law makes it hard to do it quickly. But, again, the other thing is, and I realize that this will never take off in a way that you would have to do to have a real debate about this. But I can walk you – we can walk out of this building right now, and I can take you to 5 job sites within a half hour where there are undocumented immigrants that are being gainfully employed.
I'm sure, by the way, the Texas Public Policy Foundation building being constructed across the street, everybody is legal.
Yeah, right. Like not, the ones who were painting the Capitol.
Yeah, exactly. You're not suggesting that. You have no evidence of that.
It's another very local reference.
I mean, you know, look, we set up this huge wall and all of these obstacles, but if you can get across it, our message is we have a job for you. And that's
why the business community has been so quick to break with the most conservative elements of the Republican Party, because the business community is saying, from an economic standpoint, the question of what we need to do is, from there, they say, pretty obvious. You know, we have a workforce issue. Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it seems even that issue is not the issue that we're dealing with no, the kids. These kids are not looking
I was going to say,
I got to leave Central America to get a job.
The Republicans that have sort of, you know, kind of gone on their own or gone away from the extremists on immigration reform in general, yeah, they're kind of stuck right now. Like, you got the business Bibles and badges people are saying, all right, we need to be compassionate. But yeah, I mean, I agree with Reeve. A 3 or 4 year old, or, you know, with his mom, or a 12-year-old, or even a 15-year-old. I mean, I don't think they're necessarily here looking for a construction gig. And now that Senator Cruz has kind of stolen the microphone for a little bit and said, this is what I want to do, I can expect that you're going to get a lot of people to re-push the question about, okay, well, is it fair how Cubans are treated. Jay, you and I tried to press them about a year ago on the Cuban Adjustment Act, and because a lot of people say, hey, as long as you get here and you're Cuban, that's a year of amnesty. You don't mess up, then, you know, you go through the process. I already saw United with Dreams say, you know, right before we started this podcast, so that kind of adds another layer to Ted Cruz. And I mean, is it going to answer the question this time? Because I don't think you or I ever got a direct response about the Cuban situation.
Right. Well, there's a lot of inconsistencies in immigration law. Yeah. I mean, you know, if you're from one country, you're treated different from another country. I think that's lost on the average person. And also, there's also no debate. There's zero debate that I've really heard about the fact that, let's face it, we're buying the drugs that they're selling.
Yeah.
And that they're trafficking.
Is he meaning we, like, yeah, people in this
room?
Speak
for yourself.
Todd.
Todd's all hopped up and looking.
And a lot of the reason why we have this violence in Central America is because we spent, how much was the Merida plan? $50 billion?
No, that was a drop in the bucket compared to the aid that we gave. It was, and it hasn't even been completely dispersed. And that was just mainly to Mexico. But
what I'm saying is we're spending all this money to squeeze it in Mexico, and so they've moved a lot of their operations further south.
And there are a lot of people. Some Carlos Spector is an immigration attorney in El Paso, deals with a lot of these Mexican exiles that are coming over, and he says, look, when the military got to Mexico, that's when the violence increased. So he's waiting to see how much aid does the Central American governments get? Are these going to paramilitary groups that are actually fostering this fear? I mean, you see a lot of these Central America, I forget exactly where it was published, but they're saying, okay, well, why doesn't the United States, you know, do a sort of a Plan Colombia type in Central America? And a lot of people are saying, oh, that's when the problem is going to actually explode if you get a lot of these corrupt governments with more resources. So
you just raise the cost of doing business, which means that the price of drugs go up and the profits are big, and you're never gonna. I mean, you think we're gonna eliminate illegal drugs?
Yeah. Well, this just shows you how impossible this issue is, right? Because like in the last, 10 minutes, we've just gone from secure border security to the war on drugs to
the Cuban
judicial
Act.
Appointments,
yeah, exactly.
You know.
Yeah.
Listen, it's even worse than that because, again, come back to politics. This issue is being litigated in the middle of a political season where nobody wants to do the wrong thing as far as November comes around, right? I mean, past November, whatever else, people are not thinking about the long term. They're thinking about November. And so the idea that the president's going to score anything that can be seen as a victory in pushing his end of this, whether it's the amount of money he's asking them to allocate as an emergency appropriation or any policy things, we're shut down basically as a government between now and November because of the election.
Well, isn't there going to be sort of a moment, too, though, where like the Hispanic caucus is going to – haven't they broken ranks with him over this $3.7 billion? So is he going to be able to get it through with like the Republicans are going to do it over the Democrats?
And even the Hispanic caucus is not 100% united.
No,
right?
It's not.
There are differences within the caucus.
Chairman Hinojosa, you know, gave Congressman Cuellar a verbal shellacking after the Cuellar-Cornyn bill. And, they're split. Congressman O'Rourke is not part of the caucus, but he's a border Democrat. I mean, he's split with Congressman Cuellar on this, and you want to go there?
No, I don't.
Go where?
About how O'Rourke is not part of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus.
Oh,
because he's Robert Francis O'Rourke. Anyway, getting sidetracked there. But yeah, there's a lot of division. So
let's
no, I don't know. And then what you said, the House Republicans are saying that's way too much money. You know, now he wants more money to fix a problem that he creates. Like, well,
and,
Mr. Speaker, this was a 2008, law that he's enforcing.
But cherry on the sundae, as far as that goes, is they say the president won't act and the federal government won't do anything. So the president puts a plan forward and they say we can't pass the plan because we don't trust the president to enforce the law.
Sure.
So they hold him accountable for not doing anything. And when he attempts to do something, they say we can't approve that because we don't trust him to actually follow through on what he says he's going to do.
And then he says, I am enforcing the law. It's a 2008 law. And they say, can't you take responsibility for anything?
The politics of this are going to get in the way, and they're going to make it so that, this remains an open wound or an open sore for the balance of the year. And I'm just not terribly optimistic about doing anything. Now, you mentioned earlier something about 1,000 National Guard troops. Did I not read that a bunch of the young members of the legislature, Krauss and a bunch of the other guys, said that they signed a letter asking for some kind of state action in the absence of federal action?
There was an online petition that was crafted a while back that a bunch of them,
wonder, so is there a way for the state to step in and in the absence of the federal government, whether it's through Perry's initiative or the legislature? What can the state do?
The big three allocated some money.
Yeah, it's 1.3 million a week. Step in and
overtime,
do what, though? Step
overtime.
In and do what?
Just add more boots on the ground.
To
more badges so that people can turn themselves in to more people. I mean, the one thing they could do, which is worksite enforcement and E-Verify, then nobody wants to do that. Oh God, no. We can't actually go to these work sites.
State route hardliner.
Yeah, you set it off.
He's exactly right. All the state can do as far as the state law enforcement, they cannot legally enforce immigration laws. So, like Jay said, they'd just be taking more people in, and if you would just concentrate on the border security aspect of it, then again, it wouldn't pertain to these kids or these family units that are coming in, unless they caught somebody within these ranks or something that had a warrant or something like that. But you're going to sift through all these folks coming through; it's just not going to happen.
This may be because I just am often busy following other stuff. But how did this? Obviously, this is a slow-building issue, right? How did it suddenly become so dominant in the media just in the last month or so?
The numbers of people has really gone up.
That's what it is. I mean, you're right. I mean, this has been going on, and we've seen pictures of the train, for years and years, La Bestia. And it's, you have groups and this and that. I mean, now it's just like there is no space on top of these things from, the recent pictures. So that's exactly what it is. And a lot of people on the border are saying it's like the meeting of the five families almost. The cartels had to have some agreement.
All Godfather references are appreciated enormously.
I appreciate that.
He even likes Godfather 3.
Really?
Do you really?
Wow.
That's
you guys,
a horrible movie.
It's not a horrible movie. I mean, Joe Mantegna is great in that movie. Eli Wallach and the Poison Cannoli. You want to actually talk this? We could do a whole podcast on this.
But are you just trying to get movie. Eli Wallach sympathy right now?
Because he died a couple weeks ago? Yeah. No, it's a great movie. Go back to the actual
anyway,
stuff.
Anyway, so, I mean, people,
small
it's like...
Small detour.
It is a small detour, and I mean, it's almost like a joke, but it's like some agreement had to have been made between the criminal organizations that start in Central America and go all the way up. I mean, I asked a woman from Honduras. She said, no, we knew to get smuggled by the Gulf cartel because the setas are more expensive or they're more dangerous or, you know, it's a right. different sort of bribe system once you get to Mexico and across the river. But everybody is making money. I mean, whatever cartel group is smuggling these folks, corrupt Mexican law enforcement, or to taking these bribes. I mean, it's almost like you get a pamphlet. It's like an installment plan. Like at this level, you have to pay off this person, this person, this person. So some message was out. Everybody said, "All right, let's just make a bunch of money," and then they started coming by the thousands. As well as misinformation has been widely reported about what the president's policies. The president will push back on that, and I don't think that a 7-year-old Honduran kid knows what deferred action is. But there are campaigns saying, "Hey, United States is pursuing immigration reform. Now is the time to act." You know, it's like if you act now, blah blah blah. I mean, it's we're kind of making light of it. It sounds like, but that's really what's going on. There's so much
well, that's
confusion.
Business.
Yeah, but
well,
I mean,
and the violence has really increased
has.
A lot. I mean,
Honduras. I mean, statistically, is the most violent country in the world according to the 2014 UN
it's
report.
It's right in our hemisphere. It's not far from here.
People
at all.
Talk about Mexico, which is still violent. I think their homicide rate is 20 per 100,000. Honduras, it's 90 per 100,000.
And they're all and so many
what's
of them.
Our homicide.
I don't know. Do you mean our is in this Tribcast?
Yeah,
it's about to go up. I was going to say.
You want the final word, Jay?
No, I was just going to say it's like all works on hitting the Rio Grande Valley because that's the closest point for them.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, it's the quickest. It's
are
the
you going to talk about UT?
We don't really have time. Do you want me to do now that you've mentioned it? Should we just do 1 minute?
No.
But they're expected to name a new chancellor at the UT system soon. The UT system has all sorts of problems getting along with UT Austin administration, but that seems to be perhaps calming down, although we've said that before. And it sounds like it sounds like Admiral William McRaven is going to be named the next chancellor pretty soon, but if not him, maybe Richard Fisher from the Dallas Fed will. So stay tuned for that. We don't have time to go into it now, but honestly, we've talked about it a whole heck of a lot here on the Tribcast before, so just go back and listen to old episodes. In the meantime, you can send us your questions and comments.
What kind of a life must you have if you go back and listen to old episodes of the Tribcast?
A life that is rich with, auditory
sitting
experiences.
Alone in your apartment eating cat food out of the can, maybe. Shut-ins.
And great other great people.
And great people.
Yeah. Shut-ins, notable, influential folks. Anyway, so why don't you send us a little bit about yourself to tribcast@texastribune.org. We'd like to thank Shiny Ribs for doing our music. And on behalf of Jay, Julian, Evan, and our producer Todd, who is not buying drugs from anyone, this is Reeve. Thanks for listening.
Texas Talk.
Okay.